I back rolled into the water and I dropped down, and the first thing I saw was just absolute color. And it was kind of this visual, overwhelming sensation of I just didn't know where to look and what to think. You know, do I look at this soft coral that's floating around? Do I look at these little mushroom corals? Do I look at this hard coral that is more pristine than I've ever seen? The thing that I was actually supposed to be doing on this first dive was it was a training ID dive for fish surveying. So after this overwhelming experience of my senses, I look around and I'm like, oh my God, there are so many species of fish here. I don't even know where to start. And it just becomes this kind of cacophony of overstimulation for your senses. And this sensation is something that, you know, I don't think I ever become desensitized to.
Greetings, merfolks. I'm your host, Danny Washington, and welcome to season 2 of 21st Century Mermaids. This podcast is called 21st Century Mermaids because it shares stories of women all over the world who are working to explore, understand, and protect ocean ecosystems using science, technology, storytelling, and determination with a ton of swagger and style. Guests we feature are actively contributing to the United Nations Decade of Ocean Science, a global initiative that began in 2021 on a mission to create transformative ocean science solutions for sustainable development, connecting people and our ocean. We consider the brilliant ocean warriors we interview on this podcast to be the epitome of what it means to be a modern mermaid: intelligent, talented, intriguing, and fierce. These soulful sirens are using their talents and skill sets to turn the tide toward a healthier relationship between humanity and our beautiful big blue planet. What up, mermaids? It's Danny Washington here. And listen, this is our final episode of season 2, and we couldn't be more pleased to have the next guest. I've been looking forward to having her on this podcast for a very long time. She's an inspiration and is doing some major things in the ocean world and represents women in such a brilliant way in this space. And she's a friend of mine, but also, again, a role model inspiration. We've got Mads St. Clair on the podcast today, tropical marine biologist, dive master, conservation filmmaker, and expedition leader. She's also the founder of Women in Ocean Science, which is a massive network of incredible women all over the world who are working in the ocean science space. But with that organization, she's able to fiercely advocate for gender equity and elevating female voices in the marine science world. Welcome, Mads. We're so happy to have you on the show.
Hi, Danny. Thank you so much for having me. And that was such a kind and nice introduction. You've also been a role model of mine for such a long time. So to hear you say that is just so nice.
Oh, I mean it. It comes from the heart for sure. And we've both been following each other's journeys for years now. Still haven't met in person, but that's all right. We're going to make it happen somehow, some way, which I can't wait.
In the ocean, definitely. Diving. Absolutely. We've got to go for a dive. It's going to happen soon.
Yeah. And as we're recording this, you are coming in from where? Somewhere very special.
Yeah. So I'm actually in Indonesia at the moment, one of the pinnacles of ocean life in the world, if we want to call it that. And I've just got back to Bali from West Papua, which is a rather remote region of absolute pristine coral goodness on the other side of Indonesia.
Wow. That's like what dreams are made of. I know a lot of people listening to the show have aspirations of going to Bali or Indonesia, Raja Ampat. That whole area of the world is so spectacular underwater. What originally drew you to going there, and what was the opportunity?
So it's actually a great place to start because Indonesia's held a very prominent position in my adult life. I've actually spent probably almost as much time here as I have in the UK by this point. I ended up coming out here kind of by accident. I was looking to do my dive master training when I was, I think, 21. And it was my best friend and I, we've always been dive buddies. And we were kind of the only two in our friendship group that were into the ocean and into diving. And we did biology together at university. And we had a little bit of a, I'm not going to call it a war, but a disagreement about where we wanted to go together and do our dive master. Now, I've always been obsessed with coral. And I'd learned to dive in the Caribbean, and I'd never been to the Indo-Pacific. And even though I'd heard that the coral was amazing here, I was very, very set on going to Bonaire. They had this amazing coral program, and I was really set on going there. And my best friend at the time, she was obsessed with sharks. And she was like, no, we have to go and do our dive master in a place where we can do things with sharks. And, you know, we should go to Indonesia. And she sent me this dive master and shark conservation internship out here in Indonesia. And at the time, I was kind of like, sharks, like, yeah, they're cool. And yeah, I care about them. But I wasn't 100% convinced. And anyway, I ended up letting her convince me. And anyone who knows me knows that that's a pretty difficult thing to do. I'm quite stubborn. And I found myself, I think, a few months later out in the Gili Islands, very popular tourist destination just off of Lombok in Indonesia. Never been here before. And I'm not going to lie, I stepped off the plane and I just had the craziest sensation of, I don't know, a right feeling. And that kind of was just affirmed when I first got in the water. And on this first dive, I remember we saw, these were the first sharks I'd seen alive. Until this point, I'd only seen dead sharks. Firstly, the awe that came from that was incredible. But the thing in that first dive that really blew my mind was the coral. By this point, I'd finished a degree in biology, and I really should have known that the best coral is in Indonesia and is in the Indo-Pacific in terms of diversity and places where it's very pristine. And I remember I got in the water and I saw this coral reef and I thought, oh my gosh, I have never been so overwhelmed in my life. I think I cried during the dive, and I came up afterwards, and that is really where the love affair began. Then I went on to do my master's out here. I did my thesis out here in Wakatobi. And I've kind of done this crazy thing where when I first came to Indonesia, everyone was telling me, oh, you know, the coral in the Gili's, it's good, but it's really faced many of the impacts that lots of coral has on the side of the world. There's been dynamite fishing. There's really a large amount of tourism and destruction in the coral in that area. And they were like, just wait until you go, you know, to other parts of Indonesia. And so began this kind of journey to find the best coral in Indonesia. And I found myself over the next few years going to different spots, going to recommendations. And yeah, it's been an absolute journey. And here I am post-pandemic back again and hoping to spend the next kind of year, 9 months out here again.
Beautiful. Wow. Yeah, I haven't done much diving there, but I've been to Papua New Guinea, and that for sure was top, probably the number one dive experience I've ever had in my life. It was pristine. No other liveaboards out on the water. We were solo dolo and lots of sharks, all the things. So yes, the Indo-Pacific is fabulous and for obvious reasons, it's a great place to conduct research. So tell us a little bit about what you are currently working on and what are your research projects entail?
Sure. So to kind of go back a little bit in terms of what I've looked at as a marine biologist and where my, I guess, research interests have lain. So I knew very early on when I was studying at university that my interest as a scientist was going to be anthropogenic stresses. So man-made stresses and how they impact specifically tropical marine ecosystems. My master's was specifically in tropical marine biology, so I looked at coral reefs. And prior to that, my undergraduate thesis, I looked at plastics, benthic microplastics and microplastics in species on the seafloor. And then for my master's, I absolutely knew that I wanted to do noise pollution, so the impact of things like boat noise and disturbance on coral reef fish. So I ended up coming out to Indonesia and doing my thesis on that. And then after my thesis was finished, it was really, really interesting. I was studying Clark's anemone fish, which are a type of chunky, aggressive clownfish that like to take a few nibbles at you when you're setting down camera traps in front of them. And then after that, I actually ended up kind of falling back into this world of elasmobranchs. I did a research assistant internship with Manta Trust. And then after that, started working on more kind of elasmobranch projects. And this kind of culminated in the current research at the moment, which I am working towards, which is looking at microplastic ingestion in sharks. So essentially sharks eating plastics.
Wow.
We're currently in the preparation and planning phase of the research, which I'm not going to lie is much less exciting than actually doing it. But I've spent the past year diving, running expeditions with sharks and looking at in-water plastic concentrations in various locations around the world. And it kind of made me formulate this research question, which was like, okay, I can visibly see plastics in the water. When we do plankton nets, so when we tow these nets through the water, we're finding plastic pieces. And in areas where sharks are aggregating, you start to wonder, okay, if we can see this many in the water, how many are going to be eaten by the sharks and ingested? So the hopes are that we can take samples from sharks that are already used in fisheries. So we won't be killing any sharks for the purpose of the study. We will instead be taking data from sharks either caught by bycatch or unfortunately targeted fisheries, because here in Indonesia, it's home to still one of the largest and most prolific shark fisheries in the world. But the good news is actually in Indonesia, they did have a very prolific manta ray fishery. And now, as many people know, it's a place where you come for manta ray tourism. And one of the key pieces of legislation that helped that happen was scientists being able to attribute kind of an economic value to a manta ray and how much it's worth alive versus how much it's worth when it's killed once and sold. So, you know, I'm really hoping that eventually we can see a similar kind of protection here for sharks in Indonesia, because for anyone who's, you know, seen Indonesia on social media or has dived here, there are sharks here, and protecting them like through tourism is a great incentive to stop people fishing them. So it's a difficult situation, but unfortunately, catching sharks here is the reality still.
It's still a reality. Well, we had some good news here in the U.S. this week. There was officially a ban put on the sale of shark fins, which is a huge step in the right direction, but still lots of work to do.
It's a good start.
It is a good start. Oh, my goodness. Mads, would your 12-year-old self be proud and happy and excited about what you're currently doing in your life?
Do you know what? That is a very good question, and actually one that's kind of come up for me, I think, in the last week. You know, we're getting to the end of the year and it's that time for self-reflection and looking back on, I guess, what we've achieved or what we could have done better. And for me, I've just come to the end of probably the most intense year of my career, as Danny has definitely witnessed. I don't know if any of you know this, but Danny's on my advisory board for Women in Ocean Science. Woohoo! And it's been one of those years where I was a yes man. You know, I came out of COVID and I got offered opportunities to run expeditions, to join research teams, to go and present at conferences. And it just became this year where I found myself running around. And I hate to say it, but I got into this, I don't want to say mindset, but this weird state where I was, you know, hitting a lot of things that I have a list on my iPhone that have been like life goals for me, but I wasn't even able to stop and enjoy them or even appreciate them or even kind of recognize that I'd done any of these things because I was so busy and so tired and so burnt out all the time. And so funnily enough, this week I've been thinking a lot about, I've seen a lot of TikToks actually recently that are like, people always want to do better and be better. And they look at what they're doing and what someone else is doing and think, you know, how can I achieve more and do better? But then these TikToks look back and say, hey, but look at what your 12-year-old self would say. Oh my gosh, I'm a marine biologist. Like the rest of the stuff is just noise, you know?
Exactly.
And that's how I've been feeling in just these past few days when I finally kind of stopped ahead of the Christmas period for the first time. And I think my 12-year-old self would be absolutely thrilled. I want to go back and hug her and be like, look what you did. You know, yes. This happened. And for me, I've always had a bit of a roundabout journey coming into marine science. And I've spoken about it before, but I never saw myself being a marine scientist because it was kind of a career that I really, you know, suppressed deep down. It was something I always wanted to do. But as a child, I actually always thought I was going to be a corporate lawyer.
Really?
Yeah, I was that weird kid at parties where people asked, what do you want to be when you grow up? And I'd be like, I want to be a corporate lawyer and work in derivatives, you know, that kind of annoying child.
That is hilarious.
I know. Even though I'd always had this complete obsession with the ocean and with seals in particular, that was really the crux of what made me, you know, deep down want to be this marine biologist. And then when I was 16, when one of my close friends passed away, and it kind of threw my entire life into perspective at a time when I was making very big decisions about my life. So this was the time when I was applying to A-levels, not A-levels, I was in my A-levels and I was applying to university. So this is when you pick, you know, what in the UK, you don't have like majors and minors, you just pick what you're going to do and you're going to hope it's right. And so I withdrew my application for law and I changed it to biosciences literally overnight. And I just had this overwhelming feeling of, you know, life is short. I'm not invincible. I have no idea what the future holds and how long I'll have. And I want to do something, you know, that, you know, makes me feel things, that I can make a difference, that I can change things. And I've kind of lived with that philosophy ever since. And so when I think back, not just to my 12-year-old self that kind of had a dream but didn't really feel like she could pursue it because I didn't think it was the right thing, to then being a 16-year-old throwing all caution to the wind and choosing this kind of less predictable and reliable, but more exciting and more kind of gratifying career. I think, yeah, both of them would look at me now and be like, pretty happy about that, I think.
That's incredible. And that's such a sound perspective to have, especially as a 16-year-old. So sounds like your journey, especially with the passing of your friend, would have caused a lot of self-reflection. And realizing your mortality at that age it's tough. It's really tough, especially when the world is coming at you with so many different ideas and what you should do. How do you make money in the world? How do you function? All the things. I know for me personally, I remember people telling me, like, oh, you're never going to make money if you work in marine science. Like, never. You're going to be poor the rest of your life. And I'm like, I don't know about that. There's got to be a way to make a living and still do what you love, you know? And it's definitely a uphill battle, but you're truly proof that, you know, once you set your mind on your goals and you focus on creating new pathways for your career, I mean, through your entrepreneurial adventures, your expeditions, I mean, these are all channels where you can create a lifestyle that is comfortable, that is livable, and that you're not worried about paying your bills. You know, I know it is a struggle for a lot of people. And, you know, I feel very blessed to know people like yourself who are living examples of how you can do it. And that's it. I mean, it really requires a lot of creativity, especially in this day and age, in this digital world that we live in. So let's go back to your academic journey. Tell us a little bit about some of the triumphs and obstacles that you faced as a woman pursuing a marine science, you know, degree, both at your undergrad level, but also at a master's level.
Yeah, that's an interesting journey. To go back to undergrad, so I studied biosciences as my undergraduate. Everyone thinks, oh, if you want to do marine biology, you've got to go hardcore in with marine science. Well, I actually wanted to always do marine science, but I wanted to have the biggest, broadest understanding of our natural world and biology and chemistry and physics. So I went in with biosciences and I absolutely loved many elements of the course. It also very quickly taught me exactly what I didn't like doing. I don't like physics and chemistry. Sorry for the ocean physicists and chemists out there.
I respect it.
But I very quickly realized, especially in the first year, that anytime the word ocean was mentioned, I was like, yes, this is my calling. I'll take the physics and the chemistry to hear about the ocean. But in terms of being a woman, my class was pretty well split. We had 50-50-ish of men to women in my class. I actually had a very big cohort. There were nearly 200 students because we were broad biosciences. And we often got lumped in with the biomed people for many of like our general lectures. But the one thing that always stood out to me when I was an undergraduate was the fact that we didn't really have very many female lecturers. And there were two female lecturers that I remember, and I kind of latched onto them as people to kind of respect and admire, which was great. They didn't necessarily work in the fields of science, marine science, that I was primarily interested in. But I was very fortunate to have an incredible undergraduate tutor. His name is Steve Simpson. And if anyone's seen Blue Planet 2, he does make a cameo. He is the bioacoustics guy. So he is the person who had a huge influence in me doing my master's degree, because he studies anthropogenic noise, so noise pollution in the ocean, and bioacoustics, so the sound produced, the soundscape of the ocean. And he is just this charismatic, bubbly guy. And every lecture he came in and he delivered that lecture as if it was the last thing that he would do, like, in his life. The level of enthusiasm and energy, and you could tell that he really loved everything he was talking about, and he was passionate about it and emotional about it. And he really taught me for the first time that, you know, it's okay to be emotional about marine science, because there is kind of this unspoken rule that scientists are supposed to be pragmatic and reserved from you know, feeling and being involved emotionally with their work. But Steve really showed me that, you know, it's okay to be emotionally invested. And this was around the time where I started really, you know, getting involved with the problems facing the ocean and the challenges and realizing, you know, the scales of the issues that the ocean was facing. And then fast forward a little bit, and I'm doing my undergraduate thesis. I did it on microplastics. That was really a very challenging time because it taught me the importance of having a supervisor that really believes in you and believes in your project, because I didn't really have that. It was challenging. And anyone who's worked in academia or has studied, whether it's undergraduate, master's, PhD, knows the value of having a supervisor that, you know, is in your corner, then the difference that that can make. And so, to be honest, I felt like I was very much on my own for my thesis. And it was an interesting journey, but I definitely feel like I was very stressed out. And that was the first time I kind of realized the value of like having supportive people around you, especially when you're carrying out research. Fast forward again, and I go into my master's degree, tropical marine science. Here I went to the University of Essex. I came in day one, and I remember speaking to my, he was my thesis supervisor, but also the director of the course. I think he was actually the director of marine science at the university. His name's David Smith, Professor David Smith. And on the first day, I remember coming up to him, and I've always been that type of student that's like, these are my ideas, let's do this, let's do that. I'm that person that hounds people on email. I'm sure I'm very, very annoying, but I hope that it conveys this enthusiasm. And I came in on day one, and I was like, right. And Dave knows Steve Simpson, the guy who does the bioacoustics. And I was like, right, I've got this plan. I want to do bioacoustics. I want to study the impact of noise pollution on sharks. By this time, I've been to Indonesia and fallen in love with sharks. And Dave was like, okay, whoa, 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 let's scale back a little bit. You know, like what you're proposing sounds like a multi-year PhD study at the time. I was big ideas, you know. And Dave is someone that I really wanted as my supervisor. And I told him on day one, because I already knew that he was, again, like Steve, a very enthusiastic person. He's a leading coral reef scientist. He's an absolutely brilliant mind, but also a brilliant supporter of his students. And I really wanted someone who would be able to kind of nurture my excitement and my passion, but whilst also telling me where the lines are for exactly how much I can do. And so I was very, very lucky to have an amazing master supervisor who reined me in when needed, but also allowed me the freedom to dream up this crazy bioacoustics project, which I carried out in Indonesia. But the craziest thing, and bringing it back to women, was that, again, at Essex, I didn't really, I think I had one female tutor who taught us for one or two lectures. She was incredible. But again, wasn't really in the field of marine stuff that I was looking at specifically. And she was really nice, but it just was a reminder, I guess. The thing that I took away from it was that it was a reminder about how few women there were in kind of these senior roles in academia and these senior positions. And once again, I left my master's and my undergraduate degrees with my primary role models being men, which was fine. But sometimes as a woman, it's nice to have role models that are women. And it does help with these self-beliefs of, yes, there's a place for me here in academia, especially if I want to be more senior. And also answers for me personally, as someone who does want to have a family and have children, that yes, I would be able to still have a career and make it to these places at the same time, and know that there is a system and structure in place to support me if I do make that decision. So not having these role models in these positions did kind of throw some of those things into question for me in my early 20s, and really kind of started this wheel in my head of, you know, hey, where are the women in ocean science? And they are there. For me, it was just a problem of visibility. And I think when we come on to talking about women in ocean science, this is one of kind of the key things that drove our mission is it's not that there aren't women in ocean science. It's that sometimes we need to amplify these voices and amplify these people so that we can increase the visibility for women around the world from different walks of life, different backgrounds, to say, hey, look, there's someone who looks like me that is there, and I can do this too, and to give someone that confidence.
That's brilliant. Well, let's jump into women in ocean science. Let's talk about the inception of it, and then where it is today.
Sure. So women in ocean science actually started in a very kind of small and humble way. I was out doing this research in the field at the time in Wakatobi, doing these crazy noise pollution trials with my clownfish. You know, I've been out in the field for a little bit by this point, a couple of years, and I'd seen some things that you know, there were cases of sexual harassment that kind of swept under the cover. A lot of the places where I worked, like Indonesia, there were instances where I'd be, you know, I was doing my master's thesis and I'd be on the boat talking to the boat crew who are from the local community just across the water in my broken Bahasa and their broken English. And I remember we got onto the topic of how they would never, ever let their wives or their children, their daughters, their sons, they would, but go diving or get involved with marine conservation, and how that just wasn't what women did. And, you know, it wasn't the first time in my life that I'd been aware that there were not only cultural differences, but also kind of access barriers for women around the world. But it was the first time where someone had flat out said to me, you know, to my face, like, that's a funny joke. Like, we wouldn't let our daughters become scientists. And many of their daughters were working for the project, but they were working in the kitchen doing the cleaning and the cooking with many of the wives and the mothers for this big conservation project. I kind of had this burning passion that came within me that was like, right, I want to create a space for women to talk about these very gender-specific issues that happen within the marine science and conservation sphere. So at this point, I had really, really no idea how to get started. So I made a Facebook group, and I called it Girls in Ocean Science. And I basically added every single woman I'd ever met working in the realm of marine science or conservation that I had on Facebook. And I put on the group, hey, I'm creating this group as a safe space for women in ocean science to talk about issues in the industry, challenges, to celebrate our wins, to talk about our research, our achievements, and please add anyone you know. And basically, I don't want to say overnight, but within a couple of months, we had like 5,000 people, 5,000 women in this group. It was insane. And suddenly I realized, you know, having seen things that people have posted in the group, people who'd reached out to me privately, some people saying, thank you for creating this group. Some people saying, hey, these were the experiences that I had. And then other women simply posting, you know, this is what I'm doing. Anyone else doing this? Let me know. And it just created these sub-communities. And suddenly I felt like it was so much bigger than myself. And it became, you know, this really incredible community that I'd never expected. And then I kind of found my first female mentor, who's actually not a scientist, but she is within the ocean space. Her name is Sarah Richard. She's the founder of Girls at Scuba.
Oh, love
Anyone
her.
Listening to this
yes.
podcast that is a scuba diver. Yeah, she is an absolute legend. She really was my first kind of female mentor and role model in the industry. I told Sarah about Women in Ocean Science, which at the time was Girls in Ocean Science. And she was like, right, if you need any help, anything at all, you need advice about community building, about building a website, anything you need, like, I'll sit down. And she made time with me on this liverboard. She sat down with me for like an hour and hashed out with me where I could see this going in 10 years. Did I want it to be a nonprofit? Was it a commercial enterprise? And literally sat down with me and gave me kind of absolutely all of the building blocks that I could possibly need to, you know, best take this community forwards and take it to the next step. And this for me was kind of this perfect harmony of, you know, I started this community because of a lack of visibility and a lack of role models and mentorship. And then suddenly I meet someone who reaffirms all of that, because she then provides to me the kind of level of female support and guidance and mentorship that I'd always been looking for, which again made me realize, you know what, this is something that is so important and something that is really needed in this space. And I guess I have to give Sarah a lot of credit, because she is the person who really helped me see the next step. Fast forward 5-6 years forwards, and we are now a nonprofit organization. And we have this incredible community of over 60,000 across platforms around the world. And it's become not only a really incredible community, but a really incredible place for us to advocate for different challenges that are faced by women across the industry. So it's been kind of this brilliant journey of being able to bring voices onto the main stage and to give people an opportunity to speak at these really big conferences, and also for us to speak and to kind of try and get women and gender equity and how that is kind of synonymous with a healthy ocean onto that main stage and into the forefront of the agenda. We also wrote the first large-scale sexual harassment in marine science survey, which showed a rate of 78% of women in marine science being sexually harassed, which, to be honest, everyone who saw the survey afterwards in the industry, well, women said, the most shocking thing about this number is the fact that it's not shocking because everyone kind of knew about it and no one really spoke about it.
Yeah, I would say, I mean, just from my own perspective, I think that this is definitely one of the most impactful contributions that Women in Ocean Science has made to the world because it's something that hasn't been discussed. Although women in marine science, ocean science know that it's happening. And for those listening, you know, I want to also lead forward as we continue talking about this, that this could be a trigger warning for you if you've experienced sexual harassment or sexual trauma. Fast forward to the next part if you need to. But I think we haven't discussed this at all on our podcast. And I just want to make sure we give it enough, you know, breathing room to be able to talk about it. Because I want any of our listeners who have experienced this to know what to do, how to handle it, and know that there are resources available for you. So yes, Mads, tell us about the results of the Sexual Harassment in Marine Science survey.
When we did this survey, there were a couple of things that were, you know, the goals. Why were we doing the survey? Well, number one, we just wanted to put a number on it. So when we designed the survey, we were not looking to publish the results. We were not looking to write a study that would take 4 years to publish. We want to put a number on this now. We want to survey our community, survey online. So we distributed this survey online. We had almost a thousand responses just under, which is huge. If you look at a lot of other sexual harassment surveys that have been done in similar industries, some of them have data sets of like 100 people. We wanted to put a number on this and say how many women are being sexually harassed. But then we also wanted to look at other things. So what types of sexual harassment are most common? Why aren't people reporting it? What deters women from reporting it? And do women feel comfortable reporting it? And do they know how to report it? So, you know, we wanted to basically get answers to these very simple questions. So we put this survey out, we did it. And obviously the key finding was the fact that 78% of women in this industry have experienced sexual harassment, which is huge. I mean, if you're saying 80% of 1,000 respondents, that's like nearly 800 women are saying we were sexually harassed at work. We have not published this research. It's available, the whole report, all of the figures online. We haven't published it because the way that we designed the survey, we only surveyed women. So there is a bit of an implicit bias. And anyone who knows about publishing knows that these kind of things are crazy. And, you know, some people will say, okay, well, we can't accept this number until we publish it, which firstly, I mean, a lot of surveys are done and not published. And secondly, most people aren't privy to the number of personal stories that came along with the survey. So we gave women the opportunity to write in a box about their experiences as well during the survey, not for any kind of publication, completely confidential, just so that we as an organization could listen and kind of hear about people's experiences if they wanted to. And for me, actually, it makes me quite emotional talking about it. One of the most difficult parts of writing up the survey into this report was going through many of these personal responses, because it's one thing assigning a number to something, and it's a very different thing altogether when you are reading stories from women around the world, ranging from scuba divers to on boats, in the lab, at a conference, some of them in a lot of detail, some of them not so much detail, but to really understand the kind of breadth of the experiences and a lot of shared experiences as well that women were going through. Some of the stories I'd read and I'd say, oh my gosh, this is the same story over again. It follows the same trajectory, the same pattern. And, you know, a lot of it to do within academia as well. And for me, that was one of the most, I don't know, powerful parts of the survey personally was reading these things. And we will never publish these because obviously it's completely confidential, but I think what a lot of people don't see behind the report is that these are very real women. They're not just numbers. These aren't just people saying, yep, I was sexually harassed. It's really a massive problem. But then to talk about the data that we did publish, so the types of sexual harassment. So we did ask people what types of sexual harassment outside of this, you know, personal story that they wrote. I mean, we have everything from rape through to lustful stares and unwanted touching. You know, we gave people a long list of kind of descriptors of different types of sexual harassment, ranging from, you know, crude jokes about people's bodies right through to very violent sexual assault. And every single one of those categories was answered. It really highlights the breadth and the diversity of this issue in terms of the type of sexual harassment that women are facing. Then we looked at, you know, where is it happening? Okay, so we've got sexual harassment happening, we have it happening to this many women, where are the places where we need to take action to make sure that we're safeguarding women? So the main places that were cited were university and the field. They were the two largest places by kind of an overwhelming majority. But then we also had labs, conferences, and other, which just kind of gave women to give any kind of examples outside. And I mean, when you look at it and you say, hey, university, that's a really concerning place for sexual harassment to happen. You have young, impressionable women who are going through a very important stage of their learning journey. And in my opinion, as I've already said in this podcast, one of the best things about university for me was being so supported and nurtured by my lecturers and, you know, really having that positive start to my career where I felt like, you know, I had people in my corner and allowed me to go forwards and I guess, you know, really love this career and pursue the things I wanted to pursue. So seeing such a high instance of sexual harassment coming from not just in university environments, but also when we surveyed about kind of the perpetrators from people in positions of power, it really does call into question, why aren't we safeguarding women better at university? And what can we do at this crucial point in a woman's career and learning journey in marine science to nurture them rather than, you know, create a culture where they don't feel safe? So then that led us kind of onto the next natural step, which is reporting it. Why aren't women reporting it? What's deterring them? So we asked them if they had reported sexual harassment, and if they hadn't, why hadn't they reported it? So 36% said that they did not report it. 52% said that they did not know how to report it. And 53% said that they were not comfortable reporting it.
Oh my goodness.
So yeah, we're identifying three really big things here. One is that a lot of women are not reporting it, point blank. And then secondly, we're identifying that women don't know how to. And this is a huge hole in kind of organizations and academia. How are you not informing your student body of if there is an issue, who they can come to and how they can report these things? And then even more concerning is this 53% of women that are saying, yes, we wouldn't feel comfortable reporting it. So yes, they have the knowledge of how to report it, but they would not feel comfortable doing so.
In fear of maybe losing relationships and perhaps, you know, critical people in their career. I mean, that's a lot of pressure.
Yeah, exactly. And that was kind of our final closing section of the survey, which is what are the reasons why you don't feel comfortable reporting it or you're not reporting it? And number one, as you've just said, the harasser is in a position of power that might influence the outcome or it might harm my career. And this really then, when I was writing up the survey, links back into a whole other and bigger issue within marine science. And, you know, as I've been talking about in this podcast about not seeing many women in positions of power and definitely seeing different imbalances at the top and in many of the later stages, is that there is this, it's called the leaky pipeline. It was published in a report by Canada, which goes to show that we have huge power differentials in marine science. And so you start off in the pipeline, undergraduates, about 50-50 men and women. You get to masters, it's still about the same. You get to PhD, you start seeing the first trickle from the leaky pipeline. You see the women start to drop out. Then you get to postdoc, you see a huge amount of women. And then by the time you get to senior academics, the imbalance is huge. And so what we have is a lot of young women coming into the industry. I think now even women outnumber men in terms of coming into undergraduate study. And at the top, we still have this huge number of senior male academics at the top, which obviously feeds back into problems like these with sexual harassment. And this also goes into other issues for women in the industry. For example, why don't we have women at the top? Well, a lot of women take time out, traditionally more than men, to have children, often at the cost of their career. Really, when we talk about tackling sexual harassment, we actually have to go right back and say, okay, well, it's not just about getting policies and procedures in place for sexual harassment itself, but we've also got to look at things like, you know, how can we readdress this ongoing power differential by supporting women during pregnancy? And often people don't realize that supporting women also means supporting men. So if a woman is going on maternity leave, by actually paying a man to take paid paternity leave as well, both people are then taking out that time from their career. And that in itself is actually redressing that power balance there, that power differential, sorry. So really, this survey identified for us as an organization, okay, we have a lot of work to do, firstly, on the ground with sexual harassment stuff, policies, procedures, talking to universities, figuring out why this is happening in the field, you know, how do we go forwards with this survey to directly tackle sexual harassment? But then it also opened up much larger questions for us in terms of research going forwards about, okay, well, we also want to look at things like, you know, pregnancy, support for maternity leave and paternity leave for men. And really, that is what is shaping our research interests as an organization for next year. So we hope to do more surveys like this, but kind of through a slightly different lens, which looks at other female-related issues that kind of all feed back into this same power differential. Sorry, that's a lot.
That's all right. It's much needed information. And I'm so glad that you broke it down for us like that. It's important for all of our listeners to understand this is what we're dealing with at the moment. And we can find solutions, although nuanced solutions, because every situation is different. There's possible ways to alleviate this problem of sexual harassment in the ocean space. And I think you're not only addressing the United Nations Sustainable Development Goal number 5 about achieving gender equality and empowering all women and girls, but you're also touching on the UN Decade of Ocean Science for Sustainable Development. And, you know, which you already know supports 30% of the ocean being protected by 2030. Can you tell us a little bit more about how you personally, as well as through Women in Ocean Science, are contributing to the achievement of the 30 by 30 goal?
Oh gosh, that's a good question.
It's a loaded one.
That's a loaded one. That's a really great question. I mean, I like to think that because I look at anthropogenic stresses, a lot of my work kind of feeds into, you know, protecting marine life and protecting marine species anyway. You know, that's the end goal. Identify the stresses, identify the impact it has, and then work out how, you know, we can figure out a management plan based on these solutions. That's really the end goal with most of my research is, you know, figuring out, okay, how can we translate this problem into a solution? And funnily enough, at the moment, I'm not really supposed to talk about these things until I've got like funding for them and are doing them. But one of the projects that I'm interested, well, I'm working together with someone on at the moment in developing a concept for is looking at the disturbance from boat noise in a very popular tourist destination for manta rays. And one of the things that we're interested in looking at is, you know, when we look at protecting the ocean and creating protected areas, especially 30 by 30, a lot of these protected areas have things like no take zones for fishing. So you can't fish there, or, you know, you can fish there, but in a sustainable way. But there's been a lot of interesting research in the world of bioacoustics, so noise pollution, where they actually are showing that it's important to incorporate quiet zones and noise pollution into management plans, especially in our protected areas. So this is something that I think a lot of people can kind of see visually if they have dived with marine megafauna or, you know, snorkeled with them. The impacts of boat disturbance, whether it's through anthropogenic injury, so actually striking the animals. I mean, in the Maldives, for example, in South Ari Atoll, whale shark tourism there is completely unregulated. And there's something ridiculous. Don't quote me on this, but it's like something mad, like 70%, maybe even higher, 80% of the whale sharks there show boat propeller strikes because there is so much boat traffic. But the other thing with this as well, with manta rays, is the disturbance of the noise. So you can often see manta rays will veer and change direction when they have boat noise coming overhead, if they're cleaning at cleaning stations. And so one of the things that we're interested in doing is there's a very, very popular cleaning station area. And what we want to look at is how we can protect the waters overhead from, you know, too much boat traffic, because the local community there. And I always say, you know, the local community are the best scientists because they're on the ground every day. They are observing every day. They have data that stretches back generations. And the local community and the partner who's working with me, she's one of the local community. She said, you know what? We have a problem with more liverboards at the moment. When we have so many liverboards and so many boats, we have no mantis cleaning. And then they're all gone. And then suddenly you have 20 mantis at the cleaning station. And for anyone who doesn't know about manta rays basically periodically visit these sites on a coral reef called a cleaning station, which is where little fish live and essentially clean little detritus and parasites and bacteria off of the manta rays' skin and wounds and in their mouth and on their gills to keep everything functioning and clean. So they're very, very critically important areas on a coral reef for these manta rays.
A wonderful mutualistic symbiotic relationship.
Exactly. The manta ray gets cleaned and the fish gets a meal. It's everyone thinks about the clownfish and the anemone, you know, but the manta ray and the cleaner wrasse is actually, in my opinion, the coolest relationship ever.
I love that.
No hate to the clownfish.
I mean, I as a, I love them too. But you, like you said in the beginning of the podcast, they're sassy and they will come after you if you get too close.
It's so true. It's so true.
Oh my gosh.
So yeah, I guess hopefully my contribution to coming back to the 30 by 30 goal personally is, you know, to keep kind of plugging away on my studies as small scale as they are. I'm not really directly involved in any marine protected area stuff, but I hope that the research that I do can contribute to the kind of legislation that will, you know, whether it's plastics related and helping to stop, you know, local inputs of plastics in some areas or in aggregation sites for sharks, or, you know, whether it, this study does go ahead and we can kind of designate quiet zones for manta rays in already pre-existing marine protected areas. Hopefully that will be, you know, my personal contribution to the 30 by 30 goal.
That's brilliant. Mads, I could talk to you literally for hours, and we will in person. I know we will.
We will.
You guys, those of you listening right now, if you want more of Mads Ocean and her perspective on the world, you definitely have to tune into her podcast, Women in Ocean Science. It's a brilliant podcast. So as soon as you're done listening to this episode, make sure you go and subscribe. So Mads, let's do this. We're going to round out our episode with a few fun questions. And if you can answer them under 60 seconds, then we'll do rapid fire. You ready?
Okay, love that. Yeah.
Okay, cool. So here we go. Give us a quick snapshot of your normal day at work. What does it look like?
Okay, I'm going to choose an expedition day for that because I've spent a lot of this year on expeditions. So my other kind of role is expedition leading, where I take people out to the field and I show them marine wildlife. Maybe we do a citizen science element, or it's kind of an ecotourism activity. So on these days, I wake up. I'm usually living in very basic accommodation. So let's say my most recent expedition, I wake up in my hut. My little hut's on the water. Usually the power's off by this point because until the sun is up enough, the solar power won't come on. So I wake up, I go brush my teeth. Then I have my little bucket scoop shower. That's if I've decided to shower that morning, doesn't always happen because there's no running water on the island. Then I literally throw on my dive gear. I have a cup of coffee, head out to the ocean, round up all the guys on the expedition. And then we head out, we get into the marine park, we scuba dive, we see some incredible wildlife. It's amazing. I photograph it. We get some eye identification shots and send those off to the scientists to be done. Usually I cry a bit because the wildlife is so amazing underwater. And then I just tell people I got some salt in my eyes from the sea. And then I give people a presentation, have some dinner, probably don't shower again because by this point I'm so knackered from the diving. Usually I'll edit some photos, try and post a reel on Instagram, and that's my day.
Brilliant. Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh, I love that. I love that. Okay, cool. Next rapid fire question. How can we cultivate more empathy for the ocean on an individual and community level?
Do you know what? I'm a strong believer in the fact that there's two ways to get people to care about the ocean. One is to get people in the ocean and show it to them. And two is to bring the ocean to them. And that's either via social media, virtual reality, put it in a game, whatever your weapon of choice is. In my opinion, people, in order to feel empathy for something, need to really see it and feel it and understand it. And the ocean is a very spiritual place for me. It's a, you know, it's like family. It's like coming home every time I get in it. And if I can share that experience with people, then I hope that I can help them feel empathy for it.
Beautiful. Okay, now time for some fun. As you know, our podcast features women who believe that they embody the spirit of a modern mermaid and working in ocean science and marine conservation, all the things. What is your personal interpretation of a mermaid?
Oh gosh. No one's ever asked me that before. Is this quick fire? I feel like I can get deep.
I know you can get deep.
Do you know what? I've just watched Avatar 2 as well. So my perception of mermaids slightly skewed by that. To be honest, I have wished every day since I started diving that I could grow gills and live underwater forever. For me, I hope that everyone feels that way and feels that they can be a mermaid because, to be quite honest, I think any woman who gets in the water and can kind of just share that experience with the wildlife that lives there and, you know, the sheer beauty and magic of this aquatic home. I mean, to me, that's what a mermaid is because I think I'm a mermaid every single day. And every time, actually, this is a good answer to that question. I took a client in with their first sharks recently. Again, I've done this a few times now. And having someone come out of the water and feeling like they're part of the ocean and sharing the water with these predators and being like, I'm an ocean person. And, you know, I feel this. That for me is, you know, the feeling of being a mermaid. And I think everyone can be and should be.
Yes, it could be a mermaid, merman, merfolk, whatever you want.
Merperson.
Yeah, all the things. That's fantastic. Okay, here we go. Last rapid fire question. Your vision of the ocean in 2030. How do you hope the ocean will evolve at the end of the decade?
I'm going to two-part this question quickly. Realistic view makes me want to cry. Probably shouldn't talk about it because people call me a sensationalist and negative, but I call myself a realist. And to be honest, the ocean is running out of time. We are not acting fast enough. And everyone declaring things at conferences and then not doing them does not work. That said, there is a lot of hope. There are a lot of people on the ground, people like you and like me, Danny, who are literally working tirelessly every day to actually do real things and create change. And these pockets of hope I have to believe in, because otherwise I would quite frankly go mad. And, you know, being back out here in places like Raja in Indonesia, where, you know, you have the, as you said, the most pristine coral in the world. If that's not hope, and if that's not what I want the ocean to look like, at least the coral reef environments, then I don't know what is. So, you know, I have to believe that by 2030, I want to believe in the restoration. But to be honest, bottom line, we need to get our climate emissions down. And we've got to work together on this. So
yeah, like yesterday,
20, like yesterday, like 10 years ago yesterday. So
yeah. Yeah. Well, you're doing the work, Mads, and we appreciate you. Thank you so much for taking the time out of your day. I know it's early morning there in Bali, so I hope you have a beautiful day on the water. Hopefully you're getting in the ocean today.
Yes, I very much hope so. Well, thank you, Danny. Honestly, it's been so nice. You know, as I was saying to you earlier in the call, I'm not used to being the one answering the questions. I'm usually the podcast host. So it's been really nice, actually. So thank you so much for having me. It's been an absolute pleasure. And hope to do this again soon.
Feelings are mutual.
Century Mermaids is a podcast created and executive produced by me, Danny Washington, Erica Woolsey, and Maria Soleil Bianco. Our editor and sound designer is Vagabond Podcast Productions. Thanks for listening, and catch you later, mermaids.